A major foreclosure settlement is in sight.
What would it mean for homeowners?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York, and you're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, February the 6th.
Coming up, the stock market reaches a key milestone.
The European debt crisis in 20 seconds of beautiful poetry.
And Detroit's reaction to some feisty auto industry Super Bowl commercials.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Today is the deadline for states to sign on to a settlement with the nation's largest banks over abusive foreclosure practices. The deal would reportedly force banks to pay billions of dollars to people who lost their homes, but several states, including two big ones, New York and California, have yet to officially sign on. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
This deal has been in the works for a year. Banks have been trying to limit their legal liability for so-called robo-signing. That's when bank employees signed off on foreclosures like they were working an assembly line without properly checking the documentation. State attorneys general have been trying to get the most financial relief they can for homeowners. The settlement now in the works would provide as much as $25 billion total. That would work out to around $1,500 for the average homeowner. Peter Morisi at the University of Maryland has been following these up-and-down settlement talks.
It's not that people were foreclosed on that weren't behind and indeed worthy of losing their homes, but rather the procedures and processes were not adhered to.
California and New York have been pushing for more financial help for struggling homeowners who are still in their homes but are underwater on their mortgages, and more leeway to pursue legal action later against the banks. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
$160 billion is the bailout Greece will get from the European Union if it can cut its budget down to size. Key politicians there are resisting, knowing that more austerity would be very tough on the people of Greece. This year alone has been a series of deadlines drawn and deadlines busted. Day, another one come and gone. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in London. Stephen, if you would, 20 seconds, sum it up.
The Greeks can't pay their debt, and if they default, this could an example set. Other countries in Europe could do the same, and that would leave Europe looking very lame. So the rest of Europe came up with a ruse. Let Greece off some of its debt, let the creditors lose. But in return, the Greeks must suffer austerity, pain. Trouble is, the Greeks say we've suffered enough. Refrain.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Next time we'll up the ante and try it in haiku.
All right, David, now we're going to focus on the Dow for a moment, something we don't often do, spend more than just a couple of seconds on the Dow. But today it is up almost 100% from the low that it reached back in March of 2009. It's at the highest point since before the financial crisis, and it's down just 9% from the highest point it ever reached back in 2007. Gus Fauché is senior macroeconomist with PNC Financial. He's with us now from Pittsburgh. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Gus, what's behind this? What does it tell you that the stock market has rebounded so much?
Well, if we look at a number of economic indicators, we're back to where we were before the recession. Real GDP is above where it was prior to the recession. Corporate profits are above where they were. So it makes sense, given the recovery that we've seen in the economy, that the stock market would have recovered to its previous peak as well.
But there are some things that have not recovered, and I'm thinking specifically about the housing market. Isn't that a problem if the housing market hasn't recovered and the stock market is showing us something different?
Well, I think the housing market is one piece of the economy. It's a big piece, of course, and it is still very, very low compared to where we were a few years ago. But on the other hand, if we look like things at consumer spending, if we look at business investment, those are looking stronger, and so those have made up for the weakness that we're seeing right now in the housing market.
And, of course, we just saw some strength in the job market with the Labor Department's report on Friday. Does that report look as good to you this morning as it did to everyone a couple of days ago?
I think so. You know, if we look at payroll employment, that was up significantly. We've had more than 200,000 job gains average over the past 3 months. The unemployment rate has come down, and it's come down for the right reason, that we have more jobs. And that's actually bringing more people into the labor force over the past few months. So that's a sign that people are encouraged about the way the job market is heading. Temporary services, which is an indicator of future hiring, was up. So if we look at the details of the report, generally they look quite good, and they're positive for near-term growth.
Gus Fauché, senior macroeconomist with PNC Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Missouri is holding its presidential primary tomorrow. Turnout's expected to be really low. That's in part because the votes won't count, even though the primary will cost taxpayers millions of dollars. Maria Altman of St. Louis Public Radio explains.
Like most states, Missouri has a big budget shortfall. Right now, it's about $500 million.
Yeah, you can make it $507 million.
State Senator Kevin Engler says it's a waste to spend an estimated $7 million on Missouri's primary. The Republican pushed legislation to cancel the election, but didn't get enough support.
When you have people that stand up and rally for the right for the people and about how it's so important they get to vote, knowing that their votes won't matter, they should be embarrassed.
Missouri's primaries usually do matter. But this year, the national GOP said only a few states could hold elections before March or they'd lose delegates. When an effort to move the Missouri primary failed, the state's GOP decided to hold caucuses in mid-March.
So the delegates from Missouri would count.
Political scientist Ken Warren.
But on the other hand, they haven't canceled the primary, so we're still holding really a totally worthless primary.
The head of Missouri's Republican Party, Lloyd Smith, disagrees. He says the primary's winner will still get lots of attention.
And anytime you're able to get your name out in a positive way, it has an impact on those people who will ultimately go to the caucuses.
But Smith says caucus-goers don't have to go along with what happens in the primary. In St. Louis, I'm Maria Altman for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. The International Monetary Fund warned today that economic growth in China could be cut in half this year if the European financial mess gets worse. Companies are already planning. For instance, the parent company of KFC and Pizza Hut has a profit report on the way. The 4,000 outlets that Yum Brands has in China have been making more money than the 20,000 fast food places it has here. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Yum Brands opens one restaurant every 18 hours in China. It plans to continue that growth in 2012, despite fears that China's economic growth may sputter a little.
They have a bet on China urbanization.
James McGregor is a senior counselor at APCO Worldwide in Beijing. He says the parent company of KFC is looking beyond a slip in economic growth to China's rapidly changing demographics.
Is China going to urbanize more and more? And of course it's going to. We're talking, what, 20, 25 million people supposed to move to the cities every year? And this is a middle-class meal.
But there are more fast food chains offering that middle-class meal than ever in China. That's why Yum has maintained an aggressive strategy. A couple of months ago, it took over Little Sheep, one of China's largest hot pot restaurant chains. McGregor says there's no doubt that more competition will decrease Yum's market share in China, but he says the company's profits will continue to grow. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
In Moscow over the weekend, tens of thousands of demonstrators braved horrible temperatures to attend one of two competing rallies for or against Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's campaign to regain the presidency in Russia. As Peter Van Dyke reports, the Russian economy was a central theme.
For many of the protesters, this weekend's rally came down to one key issue.
Corruption. In state organs.
40-year-old Valentin Panko says corruption is a real problem for businessmen dealing with authorities. Officials often ask for bribes for even the most mundane permits.
All businessmen, when they contact with our state, all of them feel this.
That endemic corruption is a big reason why these people are demanding fair elections. They believe last December's parliamentary elections were fixed and feel ignored by the authorities. Dmitry Marashenko is a software programmer.
There is a lot of problem because of corruption.
I think if we will stop corruption in our country, lots of problems will go on.
These mostly young, well-off and well-educated protesters don't want a revolution, and many of the changes they want could be good for business. Lev Snikov was one of 50 or so investment bankers who met with protest leader Alexei Navalny last week. He welcomes a little political instability.
In the Russian situation, it's actually a positive, a sign of positive change.
The Kremlin is already making changes, and the protesters are encouraged. Prime Minister Vladimir Putin will almost undoubtedly be the next president, but the protesters hope he will be a different president. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Los Angeles Philharmonic music director Gustavo Dudamel has become quite a marketing icon since landing in L.A. back in 2009. Now the 31-year-old conductor is taking classical music to the street, talking Sesame Street. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
So, what does this have in common with this?
C is for cookie. That's good enough for me.
The answer, Gustavo Dudamel. He's appearing on Sesame Street, where he will conduct an octopus and a sheep, playing Beethoven's Ode to Joy. Aram Sinreich is a professor of music and society at Rutgers. He says Dudamel's flamboyant conducting style and friendly demeanor are perfect for getting younger kids interested in classical music at a time when professional orchestras across the country are seeing ticket sales flag.
The long-term prognosis is not good unless the younger generations become an active part of the classical music community. Dudamel is exactly the kind of ambassador to communicate that excitement to younger audiences.
Hoping to hook those young audiences, the LA Philharmonic developed an iPhone app called Bravo Gustavo, where you swing your iPhone like a baton and control the tempo of the music. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We put names on hurricanes. In Germany, it's the custom to put a name to any old weather front that moves through, and you can buy naming rights for about $400. The Wall Street Journal says BMW's Mini Cooper line paid to call one weather front this winter Cooper to stress the all-weather performance of its Mini Cooper line. That weather system turned out to be the awful, deadly freeze that gripped Europe in the past week. BMW had to put out a press release saying that it regretted the hardship caused by Cooper. Ford is feeling like a Patriots fan this morning, as in not good, after its rival General Motors aired an aggressive commercial during the Super Bowl. You may have seen it. The ad takes place after some kind of apocalypse in which a bunch of Chevy truck drivers appear to have survived, but not their friend Dave.
Where's Dave?
Dave didn't drive the longest-lasting, most dependable truck on the road. Dave drove a Ford.
Ouch. Well, Ford wants the ad pulled, arguing that insurance industry figures prove Ford makes the safer truck. For more on this, we're joined by Bernard Swicky of the Center for Automotive Research. Good morning.
Good morning.
So is this ad by GM out of bounds, or is it just a smart move by GM?
Well, you know, because it's the Super Bowl, you expect things to be kind of at the boundaries. It's not terribly overt yet, but I think it says a lot about how important the pickup segment is to these companies that even that gets them sort of in a bit of a tiff.
Well, you say they're in a bit of a tiff. Ford actually officially responded and said, don't run this thing. Is that unusual?
Yeah, actually, that is unusual. And again, this is the one highest volume segment that we have in the automotive industry. And two, it's also probably the most profitable segment. So there's quite a bit of reputation at stake on the line here.
Now, one way of looking at this, of course, is that competition is back in a big way in Detroit after the bankruptcies and the bailouts. So I want to get your sense of how another ad is going down there in Detroit this morning. This one by Chrysler. Here's a bit of it.
This country can't be knocked out with one punch. We get right back up again. And when we do, the world's going to hear the roar of our engines. Yeah, it's halftime, America. And our second half's about to begin.
That, of course, is Clint Eastwood there. So is that a car commercial for Chrysler or an Obama 2012 ad?
Yeah, I think you could definitely read that into it. I mean, obviously a government loan is what made the restructuring of both GM and Chrysler possible.
So, yeah, you're definitely going to see these things come up in the election speeches. There's no doubt that the government has played a bigger role in the recovery of the industry in the last couple of years.
Bernard Zwicky with the Center for Automotive Research, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
The New York Giants are Super Bowl champions once again, defeating, if the news hasn't yet pierced your cave, the New England Patriots for the NFL championship once again. Giants quarterback Eli Manning was the game's MVP again, and 53-year-old Madonna performed acrobatics and dramatic dance moves once again.
And that's where we're going to focus in today's Midday Extra, David. We're going to look at what Madonna's Super Bowl halftime show says about her, our culture, and the music industry. Jocelyn Vina is a writer with MTV News, and she joins us now from New York. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi, guys.
So what did Madonna get out of this?
Madonna got a lot out of it. I mean, she brought a lot of exposure to her new single, Give Me All Your Lovin'. She brought a lot of attention to the new album, MDNA, which drops in March. She brought a lot of attention to herself again. She kind of reminded everybody why she is, in fact, the queen of pop.
It's nice seeing someone who's my age playing that kind of role. I guess it says something, do you think, Jocelyn, about the demographics of America? In fact, I just looked up the U.S. Census for 2010. I guess the typical age in America has now risen to about 37 years old. I guess halftime entertainment has to get higher along with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very typical of sort of the Super Bowl halftime show to have these iconic artists who are older. They, you know, you don't see a lot of the Katy Perrys, sort of the younger artists on these shows because her demographic doesn't reach as far-reaching an audience as Madonna, who's been around for 30 years. And I think any age knows who Madonna is and can relate to her music and sort of her imagery and her spectacle that she put on.
Did she have a greater stature as a celebrity than previous guests like Janet Jackson? I mean, Madonna did get to sing some of her new stuff in addition to the hits that obviously everybody would have wanted out of a Madonna performance.
Yeah, I think that Madonna has proven that she never really goes anywhere. I think that even when she's not doing anything, she's in the pop culture conversation. And I think that she seamlessly kind of brought together her older stuff and her one new song, Give Me All Your Lovin', which is sort of a nod to even sort of her older music that she's put out in the past. And I think that because she's Madonna, she can do whatever she wants. And producers are going to basically let her do whatever she wants. I mean, she came out in, you know, a giant pharaoh sort of, you know, thing and was carried out by gladiators. And not everybody does that, you know. I mean, that's Madonna. That's something she can only pull off.
I mean, she looked good, right? I mean, she really had most of the moves. She only stumbled, I guess, dare I say it, just once. But
hey,
I think the crowd was on her side.
Hey, I have a hard time walking down the street in the kind of shoes she was wearing. So the fact that she could even move at all on a stage in those heels is beyond me. She looked amazing. She did an amazing job.
She did do an amazing job. Jocelyn Vina of MTV News, thank you so much for talking all about Madonna and the Super Bowl with us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And finally, how low can you go? That is the question a British composer is asking in his search for someone who can sing the lowest note ever sung before for his new choral composition. According to the BBC, this is the note he's looking for. If you didn't hear that, it's not you, it's your speakers, which may not be able to play a sound that low. But if you can sing it, you might have a new career ahead of you. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio, New York, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.